Psalm 46, and it will be found on page 570 in the Pew Bibles. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Nations are in uproar. Kingdoms fall. He lifts his voice. The earth melts. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come and see the works of the Lord, the desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress.
Well, we're going to turn to Psalm 46 and think about this together. Great psalm. And as we think about this psalm, let me tell you about an event that biblical scholars are pretty sure, the event that gives rise to it. The year is 701 BC. You'll see that this is a psalm that is not written by David. David has written the bulk of the Psalms, but not all of the Psalms. And he set up a number of schools, a sort of songwriting schools, and some of the Psalms are written by other people, the sons of Korah and all of these sorts of people. And so this is one of those Psalms that's not written by David. But the year is 701 BC. King Hezekiah is on the throne in Jerusalem. Now, King Hezekiah was a good king, but he is living through some incredibly challenging days. These were the days of the might of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire controlled a huge swathe of land right across the Middle East, and just about nothing stood in its way. Very cruel empire, very powerful. And at this point, the people of God were divided into two parts, the northern and the southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom was overrun by the Assyrians. The Assyrians just swept in. They carried them off, killed many, many people. They destroyed lots of the land, and they carried the people off into captivity. And we talk about sometimes the lost tribes of Israel, the lost 10 tribes. That was pretty much the end of those northern 10 tribes. And you can read about all of this in 2 Kings 18 and 19 and Isaiah 36 and 37. And now the Assyrian king, King Sennacherib, who was a very arrogant king, he was about to do the same to the southern kingdom around Jerusalem, where Hezekiah is the king. And he sends an army of 200,000 men, 200,000 strong, and they surround the city of Jerusalem. And you can read about this in Kings and Isaiah. His spokesman, the king himself doesn't come, it's a sort of a task force, and his spokesman comes and stands outside the walls of Jerusalem and shouts abuse at the people there, the king and others there. He mocks the city, he mocks the Lord. He says, all of the other nations that we have conquered and all of the other cities that we've destroyed, their gods couldn't help them. Don't you think that your God is going to help you? We are going to destroy you. You've got to surrender. And Hezekiah refuses to surrender. And this is reported back to Sennacherib, and Sennacherib sends a letter to Hezekiah telling him that he must surrender and pointing out the foolishness of trusting in the Lord. And in a beautiful scene, Hezekiah the king takes this letter, he goes to the temple, and he spreads it out before the Lord, and he prays, and he begins to pray, asking for God's help. Isaiah is the prophet at the time, and the Lord sends Isaiah to Hezekiah to tell him that God will deliver them. Now, it's a pretty challenging situation, isn't it? How would you feel? There's a promise from God that all will be well, but there are 200,000 people just over the wall who are wanting to kill you and pull every stone in the city off each other. They are battle-hardened soldiers. There are plenty of stories of other cities that they've put to the sword. What do you do? Do you trust God, or do you collapse into a quivering wreck? Now we don't find ourselves in that situation all that often whenever we're surrounded by an army. But on the other hand, there are plenty of times whenever we are faced with that sort of same decision, isn't there? We've got that same dilemma. We know that we're told to trust in the Lord, to trust in the promises that he has made in his word. And yet there's plenty around us that would cause us to quiver and to waver. And the situation that we are in is just the same in this sense, in that we're either trusting or we're full of fear. Sometimes we're sort of in the middle, but we've got this decision, don't we? We're going to trust the Lord or we're going to be full of fear. Do we trust him or do we fear? Well, let me tell you what happens to Hezekiah. Hezekiah goes to bed, doesn't tell us how he slept. I wouldn't imagine he slept that brilliantly. But during the night, the Lord sends an angel who moves through the Assyrian army and kills 185,000 soldiers. And in the morning, the people awake, the remaining 15,000 soldiers who are there, look around them. Place is just full of death and destruction, and they withdraw. Jerusalem is saved. And soon after that, actually, Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, is put to death by his own sons. And what we think is that this psalm that we're looking at this morning is written in these circumstances. You can see verse 5, God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. That seems to be the reference to the waking up in the morning and realizing that the threat has been dealt with by God. So this is a psalm that's saying God can be trusted. It's saying this is what he is like. You do not trust him in vain. Now that's a message that we need to hear, isn't it? We have looked at this psalm a few times before. The last time we looked at it, I don't expect you to remember this. I'd be hugely encouraged if you did. But the last time we looked at it was on the 15th of March, 2020. Now, that date has got some significance. You might remember that week, Boris Johnson had come onto the television and said, you must stay at home. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And there was lots of fear around. And then this psalm was what we looked at on the Sunday. And it said, we could trust God. Now, it's not just in the face of global pandemics that we need to hear that. It's in the day-to-day ups and downs of our lives, isn't it? We daily need to be reminded of who God is and the appropriateness of trusting him. So we're going to look at this psalm, just step through it for a moment or two and say, how can we trust God? How can we know the peace that trusting God brings? And there are four things that this psalm, I think, tells us that we've got to do. First of all, we've got to know the truth. The first thing is we've got to know the truth. Look at how it starts. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. So we were in the Lake District for the last couple of weeks, and we visited an old Roman fort up high on the Lake District hills, one of the passes, and built by Hadrian around the same time as the wall. It is, of course, a ruin. None of the walls are really any higher than about 3 feet or so. Covers about the size of a football pitch. But because the walls are all still there, amazingly, the walls are all still there after 1,800 years, whatever it is, buildings can be clearly seen. You can figure out which ones are which, and it's been very helpful that English Heritage or whatever have labeled them all, and you don't have to work out what they are, but they've labeled them and told you what they are. And it's incredibly impressive. It would have been a tough place to have come from sunny southern Europe, and there you are, you're a soldier, and you're stationed in what turns out to be a pretty wet lake district and cold and all the rest of it. And you'd been out on patrol, perhaps, and some of the locals weren't all that friendly, perhaps, to the Romans. And you'd have walked back and you'd have come up over the hill and you'd have seen the fort and you'd have gone inside and you'd have felt safe. It's a refuge. And Sam is saying that God is a refuge. He's a place of safety. He's a place of strength. Those who take shelter in him can be secure and they won't be shaken. Now, we know that that's the sort of thing that we come to church and we sort of expect to hear. But if we're honest, our confidence can sometimes come from other places. The fact that we have a little bit of financial security, perhaps, or we have a supportive family, or we have reasonable health, or whatever it might be. And yet, whenever we realize it, these things are all pretty shaky because they can all be taken away. And yet, God is a solid stronghold that no one can take us out of. Now, one person I listened to in this points out that there's a doctrine in verse 1, and then there's an experience in verse 2. or in fact, there's a doctrine in verse 1 and an experience in the second part of verse 1, a very present help in trouble. So God is our refuge and strength. There's the doctrine. There's the truth. Here's something that tells us what God is like. And then a very present help in trouble. There's the experience. This is something that the psalmist had lived through. He'd woken up in the morning, realized that God had undertaken for them, and they'd lived through this. Something that we've come to understand because of what we've experienced. And the psalmist is saying, I know this is true. That was always what my Sunday school teachers taught to me. God is a refuge and strength. But I also now know from my experience he's a very present help in trouble. And you see, if we're a little bit further down the road as far as a Christian life is concerned, we not only know the theory, but we've had the experience, haven't we? We've known that God has been trustworthy. We've trusted him. He's got us through situations. And we realize we can look back and we can say, well, if God helped me there, he can help me with this also. But here's the thing. What if we don't have those experiences to call upon? Maybe we're younger or we're younger in the faith. And we don't have years of experience of God's faithfulness to look back on. What do we do then? Well, there are a couple of things we can do. First of all, we can familiarize ourselves with the Bible because there are stories like this, stories of Hezekiah, that help us see what God has done then, how God has come through for these people. And we know he's the same God who will come through for us too. And then the other thing that we can do if we don't have that sort of bank of Christian experience is we can spend time with people who do. It's one of the reasons that God puts us in a church family, in a Christian family, with Christian brothers and sisters, some of whom have been following Jesus for decades. And as we get to know them, we can see and hear from them how they have proven the Lord down through the years. It's one of the things that some of us who are older are able to do. Just come alongside those who are younger in the faith, and say, do you know, this is how the Lord has helped me. Let me tell you. We'd be honest about our struggles, and we say, you know, I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to make it then, but the Lord was faithful to me. Maybe you're going through a hard time just now, and part of how the Lord might use that is that in the future, you would come alongside someone and say, do you know, there was a time whenever I was facing this, and it was so difficult, but the Lord helped me. And therefore, you can trust him in the things that you face too. So that's the first part of how we trust the Lord like this. We know the truth. We know who God is, both from our knowledge and from our experience. So that's the first thing, know the truth. The second thing is we apply the logic. We apply the logic because what the psalmist does next in verse 2 is he applies some logic. Now, I don't know if you think much about logic in the Bible, but there is lots of logic. There's lots of the Bible saying, this is what God is like or this is what God has done. Therefore, that's logic. And here's the logic. Verse 1, God is like this. And then here's the logical conclusion in verse 2. Therefore, we will not fear. God is our refuge and strength, therefore we will not fear. You see, it's logical. If this is who God is and this is what he's like, we're not going to be afraid. And the psalmist takes the logic further and effectively says, we won't fear even if the worst possible situation arises. You see, we will not fear though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. So this is describing the worst situation imaginable. It's not just that the circumstances of your life here have become difficult. It's not just that there are 200,000 enemies camped outside the walls. It's that the very world itself is falling apart. And that's what this is describing. Remember, at the story of creation in Genesis chapter 1, God creates the world and everything in it, and as part of that creation story, God distinguishes between the land and the sea. This is what Genesis 1, 9, and 10 says. God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. So you see, dry ground, or land, appears out of the waters, out of the seas. And that's what happened at creation. That's why we're in the world that we're in. And what's happening in this psalm is that that's being reversed. The mountains are falling into the seas. In other words, the very world is coming apart. Creation is being undone. Things that shouldn't move are collapsing. It doesn't get any worse than this. That's what the psalm is saying. That's what it's describing. And the psalmist is therefore saying to us, now, if God is God, he is our refuge and strength, even if that happens, even if the worst happens, whatever happens, we won't fear. Last time we looked at this, I quoted someone who said that, well, what we need to do is we need to turn our what ifs into our even ifs. It's really helpful. Whenever we're threatened with a situation, if you're like me, you sort of lie in your bed and in the middle of the night and you turn things over in your head, don't you? You say, well, what if this happens and what if that happens and what if that won't work out? And what this guy was saying, and it's right, is we need to turn our what ifs into our even ifs. Even if that happens, I will not fear. Even if that happens, God can be trusted. Know the truth, apply the logic. And the third thing then is draw on the strength. Now here's this little section that looks at the strength that God gives his people. And he does that, psalmist does that, by talking about a river. Verse 4, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. Now the notable thing, of course, about this is that it's talking about Jerusalem, the city of God, but the city of Jerusalem is not built around a river. Lots of places that you go to are built around a river. London, built on the Thames. Rome, built on the Tiber. Paris, on the Seine. All of these sort of great cities built around rivers. Portadown, built on the Bann, you know, that sort of thing. And yet Jerusalem is not like that. It doesn't really have that great river because it's on the top of a mountain. And there was really only one significant water source that was coming into the city. It was a little river that ran into the pool of Siloam from the Kidron Valley. And whenever there was a siege, of course, it was a water source that was easily blocked by the enemy army. And Hezekiah, in his day, dealt with that. He started a tunnel. And some of you might have walked that tunnel. The Bible tells us about how it's dug, and you can go and walk through it now. They began to dig it from both ends, and they didn't have lasers and theodolites and all the things that engineers use today. And so what they did was they dug and they listened for each other. And if you plot the tunnel on the map, it's a little bit twisty, yet they managed to listen to each other, and they dug from each end, and they met in the middle. And what that did was it brought the water source in under the walls and into the pool of Siloam, so that even if there was a siege, the city had a water supply. And so you can see that it's appropriate to say, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. Now, of course, there's a bigger picture here that's running all the way through the Bible, and that is that God's strength and blessing for his people is described as a river. Think of Psalm 1 when it describes the blessed man. He's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in season, its leaf does not wither. He's sustained by the Lord. He prospers. You think of Revelation where God's people are gathered in glory. And how is God's provision and blessing described at the end of Revelation? It's like a river. Revelation 22, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. God's people sustained by God himself, and it's pictured as a great flowing river. And we know this is true, don't we? God sustains his people. At an individual level, haven't you been just awestruck sometimes whenever you've seen a Christian brother or sister going through hugely difficult times, and yet they seem to be drawing on a strength that is just not natural. It's supernatural. It's God. God is supplying them, sustaining them, and helping them. And you can't help but ask, I wonder what would happen if I was in their shoes. Would I be able to respond like that? Would I be able to make it like that? They just flourish even though things are hard. God is sustaining them. And then it's a corporate image. It's a together thing, of course, here. Don't we hear stories of churches, and especially in places where there's persecution, and they're facing dreadful opposition, and yet they are flourishing because there is a river whose streams make glad the people of God. God is sustaining his people. And you see, whenever we think about learning from others, this is one of the things that we can learn. We can learn that God sustains his people. And sometimes we don't get that because we don't ask for that. Would God give strength to those who do not ask? He would not withhold strength from those who do. God helps his people. You see, verses 5 and 6, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. That seems to be that reference to the morning when Hezekiah gets up and he looks over the walls, maybe a pretty bad night's sleep. I've trusted the Lord, he says. What's God going to do? And he looks out, and he sees the destruction of the Assyrian army. He utters his voice, the earth melts. You see, the Lord sustains his people. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. So we've got to draw on his strength. God delights to help his children. He is in the midst of us. And so we must ask him and depend on him and trust him, and he will sustain you like a mighty river. And he'll not just get you through. Do you see that little reference? It says, there is a stream that makes glad the city of God. He'll give you joy even in the midst of the challenge if we will look to him. Draw on the strength. And then the last thing, just to wrap up the psalm, just in a word, is we invite the world, because this is not just for us, it's for the world. I don't know, this didn't happen to us in England, but we have been on holiday in some of those places, more maybe in Europe or further east, and you've been walking along a little street at night, and there are little restaurants, and there are always guys out the front. It's the way they seem to start in the business. You go out the front and get in the customers, you know. And there they are. They say, please, would you like to come in? And they hold up the menu and you see your fish and chips. And you say, these are the best fish and chips in Bodrum. And they try to persuade you to come into their restaurant. And maybe they're just doing their job. Maybe they're trying to get onto the ladder. Maybe some of them, there's got to be somebody who knows that they really do have the best meal in all of the country. Well, the psalmist here knows that what he experiences of God cannot be better. And so what he does is he turns to the world and he says in verse 8, come, behold the works of the Lord. How he's brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. You see, God achieved a great victory when he brought desolation on the Assyrians. But one day, his victory will be seen by the whole earth. He will break the bow and shatter the spear. All wars will cease. He will be rid of sin, and only his triumph and his people will remain. And we often take this little line here, be still and know that I am God, as a comfort for God's people, and it is, but it's more than just saying don't fret. It's actually saying to the nations that are in uproar against God, lay down your arms, submit to me, cease your hostilities. Isn't it graces of God to say that? To invite those who are warring against him and saying to them, now won't you stop running from me? Won't you cease your rebellion? But that's the gospel, isn't it? That's what he says to us. That's what he calls on all people to do. Stop running from me. Cease your hostility. Come and bow before me. And maybe some of us are thinking, do you know, that is me. I know that that's what I'm supposed to do. Some of us who are here or some of us who are listening. And we think, well, I'm not really sure. I know I'm supposed to do that, but I'm not really sure that this message is for the likes of me. Well, can I point you to something here? There's a way that God describes himself here that is really beautiful. It would take too long to unpack, but let me say just a word about it. He describes himself as the God of Jacob. He does that twice here. Now, Jacob was not a great character in the Bible. He was a deceiver, he was a swindler, and yet God took him and he changed him. And God continued yet to describe himself as the God of Jacob, as if to say, do you know what? I can rescue you and I can save you. If I can save him, I can save you. And it's not by coming and turning over a new leaf and impressing me. It means surrendering to me. It means ceasing your hostility. You think of how that term, be still, might be used. In what context would you use that in a rescue? You know, for example, if you were saying to someone who had fallen into a bit of a hole, now look, you need to climb up here. You wouldn't say to them, be still. You would say, reach a little bit further. That's it. You're nearly there. That's not the gospel message. The gospel message is, be still. It's what you would say to someone if you dived in to save them from drowning and you wanted them to stop struggling so that you could bring them to shore. Be still. I've got you. And that's what Jesus does. It's what he's done for us. It's what he can do for you if you're one who yet needs to know him. Know the truth, apply the logic, draw on the strength, tell the world. God is our refuge and strength, therefore we will not fear. Let's pray together.